Hello and welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. My name's Craig Barker and I'm the head of public engagement for the museum. Now, Object Matters is a podcast in which, in each episode, we explore the personal relationship between a guest and an object in the museum collection. So I'm really, really excited to introduce the guests for this episode. A big warm welcome to Lauren Poole. Lauren is a disabled postgraduate student in Museum and Heritage Studies at the University of Sydney. She has a Bachelor of Arts in Archaeology and English, and her writing has appeared most recently in the publications Growing Up Disabled in Australia and Earth Cries, a Climate Change Anthology. Lauren, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Craig. Thanks for having me.
Now, I'm very, very excited to find out what object you've selected for the episode today. But before we get to that, can I ask you to speak a little bit about your own background and your own research interest and how you came to be studying a postgraduate degree in museum studies?
Of course. Well, my formal background, as you mentioned, is in classical archaeology and English, so particularly Bronze and early Iron Age Crete. And I went from there into museum and heritage studies because it was honestly a great way to just study everything, because everything and could end up theoretically in a museum, be used in a heritage practice. And I have a terrible tendency to want to learn about each and every topic that comes across my path, which is reflected somewhat in my research interests. So my upcoming master's dissertation is on climate change and loss of heritage sites. I've written about ruins and ruin porn, heritage in pop culture, medical history, and now disability history.
Fantastic. It's nice to have a wide range of interests, but that's an extremely wide range of interests, Lauren. Now, before we start to talk about objects and relationship with objects, could you talk to our listeners a bit about your own disability? And as someone living with a disability, like many, many other Australians, how that has impacted upon your relationship with museums?
Yes, so I have an acquired brain injury, have had for a number of years. For the purposes of the specific object that we're talking about today, the facet of that injury that's most pertinent is that I have something called dysautonomia, which is an umbrella term for a bunch of conditions that involve dysfunction of the autonomic nervous system. And your autonomic nervous system controls things generally that are unconscious bodily functions. So your heart rate, blood pressure, your temperature, respiration, digestion, all that really fun stuff. And I actually have two types of dysautonomia. I have postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, which is also called POTS, which is a great thing to have if you're an archaeologist. And I also have orthostatic hypotension. And those are both postural conditions. So when I sit or stand up, they get significantly worse. And as you can imagine, that has a big impact on someone's life.
I'm sure. So, I mean, it's interesting because the museum sector, the glam sector, galleries, libraries, archives and museums, like so many other parts of Australia, have really been going under something of a reappraisal in terms of how we accessible and accommodating to visitors and visitors with specific needs. But ultimately, we are still very much ableist institutions. We are an extension of ableist societies more generally, of course, aren't we? So as someone living with a disability, how do you engage with a museum collection, and what are some of the ways that you have seen improvements within museums, and where are some of the things that we are quite clearly failing upon? I'm conscious of the fact that, of course, you can't speak for everybody with disability, but from your own experiences.
From my own experiences, I think the area that the sector is improving on is literal accessibility. That's becoming much more standard, and there's an increasing recognition that accessibility is a lot more than just ramps or braille. It's so many other things, and often that accessibility can mean almost contradictory things to different people. So one person might need very bright light to navigate, somebody else may need a dim environment, and that we need to make sure that all of those needs are catered for and that disabled people fundamentally have a right to access institutions, to be in them, to find meaning in them. What I think is less acknowledged and has not been dealt with very well are some of the more subtle ways that ableism appears in museums. And I think part of that's because people have internalized ableism. It's how our society functions. It's the norm of our society. And so we tend to only look at the most blatant examples of it and think that that's where it stands. So when someone can't physically get into a building, that's a very obvious display of ableism. Or the language we use, and I apologize to have to say these words, but things like stupid, lame, suffering, crippling, insane. These are all words and terms that we still use in museums very commonly. There's also sometimes we perpetuate stereotypes, like the mad genius is a really common one. Or the idea, which is still repeated in a lot of places, that mentally ill and neurodivergent people are threats to object safety. So those are some of the most sort of openly awful ways that ableism appears. But it's also in the implicit assumptions we have of visitors, right? That they demonstrate able-bodied or able-mindedness, that they have to behave in particular ways, that they have to express themselves in particular ways, move through space in particular ways, and show a deference to institutions. If you're not nice to the museum and present yourself as like the ideal disabled person, they may not let you in.
No, they'll also consider.
There's that old sort of example of museums want Van Gogh's art, but if he turned up manifestly mentally ill, they wouldn't let him in the door.
Very interesting observation. Now, it's interesting because, of course, you're talking primarily there in terms of the experience of a museum goer or user, but as a researcher such as yourself, there's probably also additional complications and barriers that are erected in terms of access to information and the way that collections can become accessible more broadly to any type of researcher or any type of investigator who's got a disability. Have you found that to be the case?
Yes. I think there's a very front-of-house approach to accessibility, which is we do it for our visitors, but there's still an assumption that disabled people don't work in institutions, they don't engage within them, they don't volunteer. And part of that is because disabled people can't always say that they're disabled within institutions. It's not always safe for them to do so. And because we put up barriers to that with the sort of advent of the pandemic, weirdly, in some ways, it's made it a lot easier to work in the cultural sector because you can work remotely. There are different time pressures that you can work around. You don't have to be sitting in an office with bad air conditioning, passing out on top of an object. So that's a very practical way it happens. And sometimes it is, I have encountered people in the sector who go, oh, but there's no disabled people here. There's no one working here. There's no one studying here who's disabled. And that is a very strange thing to say when there are disabled people in the room. And I think we need to start to confront that in the industry.
I mean, you talk about how the pandemic has created an impact with things like increasing digitization and putting a lot more information out there for broader access, full stop. But from the perspective of people living with disabilities, has that made a dramatic impact in terms of, again, information gathering, access to collections and things like that?
Yes, I've found that, but I've also found it's being rolled back as sort of lockdowns are ending and we're moving into different phases of the pandemic. There is an expectation that we go back to previous modes of working. And I also think there's some interesting questions that come up around what types of digitization and digital accessibility we're actually putting forward. Because a lot of it can tend to go down the I am telling you, I am teaching you mode. And so what about for visitors who want to have more effective emotional or tactile engagements with heritage places or with museum objects? How do we do that for people who it may not be safe to return to institutions with COVID becoming endemic? How are we catering towards those people and realizing that there are homebound and bedridden people in our society always and who have not been given access to institutions?
That's a good point too, because I mean, so much effort's been made in terms of face-to-face contact within a museum context, both through education programs and object-based learning programs, and even a podcast like this about giving multiple different opinions and voices to an object and the relationship between the object and its intellectual, its aesthetic, its personal connection and so on and so on. But by becoming digital, again, by only bringing it back to a single voice of authority, you run the risk of eliminating that access too. So are there perhaps ways that we can explore finding more voices?
I think it's also what those voices are saying. So you need multiple voices, but also if you're taking someone on a digital tour of a heritage site, for instance, and you're saying this house was built at this time and these people lived here and X, Y, Z, I can probably find that information on your website. I don't always need someone to be telling it. What I can't know is, for instance, how does it feel when the seasons change in the space? How does it feel to walk through these? Do you walk through and go, oh, you know what? I suddenly feel very enclosed. All of the trees have gotten a lot denser as we move through this section of the property. You can really smell this particular flower that's in bloom and that's been blooming here for the last 70 years. The light, all of these things that are part of the experience when we go, but are often neglected when we try to communicate through digital programming.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Thank you, Lauren. Now, it's interesting because the object that you have selected from the collection is a piece that you've recently given a conference paper on, or it's included in one of your conference papers, I should say. But it's interesting because it's linking in with your other areas of interest and research and experiences as well, for that matter. Could you let our listeners know what the object is that you are focusing as your object matter choice for this episode?
Yes, so the items, I should say the objects that I've chosen are 150 parts from the prototype of the cotton aerodynamic anti-G suit, which is also called the cotton suit, Dr. Cotton's anti-blackout suit, or in one case, the pneumodynamic suit, which sounds very exciting.
Like a superhero costume, isn't it?
Amazing. If everyone calls it a different thing, it's brilliant.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll delve deep into it in a moment, but in part because of the way that it was developed under the Top Secret Acts and so on as well, that, you know, it probably never really had an official name at any point, or I could be wrong on this, but again, it's kind of let the imagination run wild a little bit now that it has become public. But I guess, could you explain to our listeners who haven't had a chance to see the suit, or rather, as you say, the pieces of the suit that have survived, what is the cotton suit? What does it look like and what's it made from?
At first glance, it really just looks like a collection of quite aged, mottled, brown rubber clothing. There's no other way of describing it than that. So there's leggings, belts, shorts, boots, and they all have quite unusual attachments and openings. So there's zips up the side and the front so you can get them on and off, bits of tubing sewn down the seams of the leggings and noticeably protruding open valves all over the place. And the parts include also various things to attach to the suit, so even more tubing and its own test dummy, which is very convenient. And because of how they're designed and displayed, they're very three-dimensional objects. They're not flat. They really do look like the body parts that they have been shaped around. They sort of stand up on their own in the display.
Yeah, now look, it is an object that is incredibly fragile, and we'll talk more about that a little bit later on as well. But it is currently on public display at the time we're recording this in the exhibition called Object Art Specimen. And I must say that showing school students around and general visitors to the museum, it's one of those objects everyone stops to look at, and everyone kind of has a moment of, what's that? Or, wow, isn't it amazing? It really is a showstopper. But I guess what drew you to be interested in it, besides the fact that it's an interesting piece?
So I actually came across it physically visiting the museum, which was a joy, having been in lockdown for nearly 2 years, to finally get to some museum objects. And honestly, the first thing that brought me in is, I think, what appeals to everyone, that it's a weird-looking thing. There's very much a sense of going in being like, is there half like a rubber body in the room, in a case? Why on earth is it over there? And reading through the display, which is very lovely, everyone should go see it. The fact that it was referencing blood pooling, and that was part of what the suit was essentially designed to counteract, and go into how that actually happened, that immediately connected to my own daily experience. Part of dysautonomia is that many people have quite severe blood pooling. So in the postural conditions that I have, when anyone stands up, gravity pulls blood down and your body compensates by doing things like constricting the vessels in your lower limbs. And you don't do any of this consciously. Your body just does it for you. But in my conditions, and in a lot of dysautonomia patients, those mechanisms don't really work. And so the blood, more and more blood, pools in the lower extremities. And in my case, my heart beats faster and faster to try and pump it back up, which doesn't work. And the lack of oxygen to vital organs then generally will result in me fainting, falling over, passing out, having very low blood pressure. So this was essentially an object that would hypothetically be very, very helpful in daily life, and was part, I saw a strong link to what my lived experience of dysautonomia in the object and the history and what it would have been like for the people creating it and using it.
I'd like to come back and explore that with you in some more detail in a moment, but let's go back to the suit itself. When was it made, and who made it. Obviously, Frank Cotton is the key figure in the story here, but who was Frank Cotton and why was he making this suit? What was the rationale behind it?
So the suit is about 80 years old, give or take, 1941 to 1944. And so the suit, it was developed by Frank Cotton. It was his idea, but there were a number of people here at UCID that helped. He was a lecturer in physiology at the University of Sydney in the early to mid 20th century. And he developed this suit with the support of the university, the National Health and Medical Research Council, and the Royal Australian Air Force. And with the outbreak of World War II, there was a real problem of combat pilots blacking out when they were in the air. Because as G-forces increase while you're flying, the blood drains away from the upper body and they would start to lose vision and then become unconscious. And if anyone's ever fainted, it's a very similar reaction of feeling like the edges of your vision start to go a bit dark, feel like you're falling over. And something that could prevent or even slow that blackout and loss of consciousness would obviously be safer and more pleasant for the pilots, but it's also a tactical advantage in combat. And Frank Cotton had a previous research interest in gravity in the cardiovascular system, and he had this idea of trying to apply counter pressure to the body to prevent the blood from pooling in the lower extremities. And so what became the Cotton suit worked by applying graded counter pressure from the feet up to about the lower ribs, hence why it's all boots and leggings and shorts and socks. And it did this by essentially automatically inflating a series of air sacs in proportion to the G-force the pilot was experiencing and then deflating them as the G-forces increased. And it would have felt a bit like having a series of blood pressure puffs all up and down your legs, which start inflating from the feet up. But unlike a blood pressure cuff, which is adjustable, the air sacs had to be coordinated in sequence and correctly fit each pilot's body. So they ended up making them with a lovely silk lining on the inside, then air sacs, and then several layers of rubber on the outside, which would occasionally burst because of the high pressure and because they have to be tested in a centrifuge. And so you can see on some of the prototype parts that there are these patches put over where the various air sacs and rubber have burst, and a number of suits were ordered by the Royal Australian Air Force, particularly for Spitfire pilots who call them Zoot suits.
Yes.
Just a fabulous name. But unlucky timing meant they never actually saw combat.
Yes, right. So they were in development right throughout World War II, but really perfected at the end of the war from a technological perspective, and so weren't actually being used by pilots during the war. Is that correct? But of course, this is also with the advent of increasingly by the end of the war with jet engines. So obviously, A, the planes were going faster. They were breaking, eventually the speed of sound, but they were breaking through the various levels of G-forces increasingly. So from a military and from a technological perspective, the need became more and more significant as time was going by. Is that the case?
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
So it's interesting. This is a piece of Australian research at the University of Sydney that then would have had technological implications not just for the Royal Australian Air Force but for pilots and any workers involved with any type of industry pushing the barriers of G-forces, really massive implications. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the Cotton suit was one of a number of pressurized similar suits that were developed in the early 1940s. So there were some in the US and Canada and the UK. So there was particularly the Franks suit, which is no relation of Frank's Cotton, but deeply confusing.
Well, having a rubber suit called the Cotton suit is confusing to begin with, as it is.
And then there were early American G suits as well. So his idea of having gradient counter pressure was both an important step forward, technologically and theoretically, but it was also one that was shared. There was a real joint effort to figure out a way to stop people passing out in midair.
And what were the flow-on effects of the research? I mean, was the Cotton suit eventually commercially used or militarily used, or was some of the theoretical and technological developments picked up by other developers for the next phases of this type of suit?
The Cotton suit itself, I don't believe, was actually used, but iterations of it are using the same principles continue to be developed, particularly ones that were lighter and frankly easier to wear. It was a real issue that Australian pilots were fighting in tropical conditions and wearing these enormously thick suits.
Yeah.
And it became a precursor to pressure suits that were used in space and the development of space industry, essentially.
Yeah. So how did the cotton suit come to be in the collection of the Chow Chak Wing Museum, or in the Maclay collection as it was originally?
Yeah, so the prototype pieces seem to have remained at UCID on campus throughout their life. And they were rediscovered in the mid-90s during renovations at the old medical school. And so in 1995, they were transferred from the Department of Physiology into the Maclay collections, and from there into the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection. Yeah.
And I mean, I know, talking from my colleagues in the conservation team, that it is a challenging item in the collection to take care of. Of course, not all of the pieces are on display, but it is an incredibly fragile piece. From a tactile perspective, and you know, as someone who's spent a lot of time reading about this piece and looking at this piece, do you find that really interesting in terms of it's something that ironically is so much newer than some of the classical antiquities that you've studied as an archaeologist, and yet so much more fragile than some of the pots and statues from ancient Greece and ancient Rome?
I think I would love one day to actually handle it, but I know that that's very unlikely and I'm very clumsy. Part of me just wants to know just literally what the rubber feels like. I wish we could almost get some samples of what was used that have been sort of appropriately aged, just to get an idea of what it would feel like. And also, I'm fascinated by what it would feel like on the body.
To wear, yes.
How it would actually feel, because it's such a thick, compared to modern sort of compression garments, which we'll talk about later, it's very thick. Having multiple layers of rubber and air sacs and silk and patches and valves, it's a lot. And I do wonder how that would have felt, because that's a lot of stress on the body. Heat can lower your blood pressure anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a bit of a...
So the very problem they were trying to solve, they may have actually been exacerbating sometimes.
Yeah, that's a real concern.
Presumably there are surviving accounts of the test pilots, and you know, given that these were being clinically trialed effectively, that there must be some sort of accounts. Are you aware of any of pilots talking about discomfort wearing them, or conversely success, that you know, I could loop my plane without any problems?
I don't know of accounts directly. I haven't been able to get the primary sources, but there are a number of secondary sources talking about that pilots found real benefit in wearing them, and that they felt they could actually feel that they weren't passing out as quickly, but also that they complained that they were hot and heavy and they had to be individually put on. And there were concerns for a while that it was very difficult to bail out of a plane if you are wearing one of these cotton suits. And so there's, I believe, one death that was attributed to someone who was wearing a cotton suit.
I imagine if the aircraft caught fire, being in a rubber suit, this must be, you know, in many ways the worst scenario that would have been imaginable as well. So
yeah, and also because there were additional things that had to be added to planes to accommodate the suit, so that you would have the correct gases to be pumped into the air sac, that it would all be calibrated so it was actually increasing pressure as the g-forces increased, and then decreasing appropriately. Yep. So it was also a need to sort of retrofit other equipment to make using the cotton suits a viable option.
So obviously it's a very significant piece, both in terms of the University of Sydney's history, but also in terms of Australian technological development and World War II more broadly, and aviation and associated industries. But obviously, you know, the development of the pressure suit, or pressurized suits, or compression suits, have changed dramatically in the intervening 80 years. So from a 21st century perspective, besides this being an interesting curiosity in terms of the early steps, what are the, you know, what's changed? What is different about the way that a pressurized suit or a compression suit would be manufactured today?
I might take a bit of an odd approach to that question and say that what I see the biggest parallel between in terms of the cotton suit is not necessarily modern pressurized suits for industry or for the military or for space, but in terms of what are called sequential compression devices. And these are medical devices which essentially use the same ideas as the cotton suit. It is an inflatable, if you've ever seen one, you can't stop looking, they're bizarre looking things, enormous inflatable boots that go up both of your legs with a bunch of valves on the inside that connect to a terribly whirring machine.
Yeah.
Which essentially applies rated counter pressure to the body, to the lower limbs, to help with blood pooling, to help with circulation. For people who may have had surgery, it's quite a common thing if you are needing to stay in bed for long periods to make sure that you don't develop clots.
Yep.
And I particularly want to draw that comparison because I have sort of a methodological question about this object, which is, why would we look at modern sequential compression devices, which are incredibly similar to the cotton suit? And we understand that as a medical object, and we can understand that in a disability histories approach as a disability object.
Yep.
And why do we not see the cotton suit, which is very, very similar, as a disability object? Yeah. Why do we make those choices, and where do we go from there in sort of confronting why we are looking at things in these ways?
Well, I mean, that's a really interesting discussion point, and indeed it kind of pulls together all of your other areas of research and interest. But you are right, because, I mean, in terms of the cotton suit, when we have presented it historically and in its current context, it's very much through the lens of the perspective of its influence on aviation, its influence on technology, part of the University of Sydney's story of our role in research and development and technological improvements. But I must admit, again, you know, as someone who's seen the object for many times, until I'd heard your presentation, I hadn't thought about it through this lens. So bringing it back to this discussion about presentation and representation of a whole range of different aspects and voices and perspectives within a museum collection, how could we best bring the cotton suit and other objects in the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection to be viewed through the lens of disability history?
To answer that very large question, I think we need to go back to a definition of ableism. So ableism is where the ideal, the norm, the standard, the expectation, the thing that people's lives and identities and society, all of our norms is built around, is an able-bodied or able-minded one. And that is a really helpful thing to think about when we look at object interpretation and how we tell stories, how we collect and value things in the first place, because we often do so assuming that non-disability or able-bodied or able-mindedness is the norm, that each object is a non-disabled object as standard.
Yeah.
And that, so ableism construes disability as deviant or deficient or marginalized. And that's really clear when we think about what stories we tell about objects, because we assume that a disability object has to be something different.
Yep.
It is not standard.
Yep.
And from a methodological point of view, that's a really helpful thing to start to acknowledge when we do object interpretations, that we think of collections as being full of non-disabled objects that tell non-disabled histories in non-disabled ways. Mm. And starting to confront that is really fundamental to telling disability stories, disability histories, disability cultures.
That's a very, very important point. Thank you for making that line. And I must admit that since we've been discussing doing this podcast, I've begun to reframe how I think about the suit myself. And, you know, again, it's small steps, but how can we start to reframe those questions? So this is a very important conversation to be having on a broader sense beyond the cotton suit, for more general. And I know that, yeah, for example, we're both Mediterranean archaeologists, that there's increasingly conversations within our field about disability in antiquity and interpretations of disability through archaeological artifacts. Again, how can museums start to tell these stories better, taking it out of academic discussion and actually reappraising objects that and material culture that may reflect some of those broader discussions?
So I see a really important distinction between disability culture and, for lack of a better term, sort of disability heritage. So it's really important that we, and disability history has been doing this since the 1980s, that we look at disabled stories and find disabled people in history and think about historical events through disabled ways of knowing, disabled ways of recognizing. But I think one of the things that museums really need to do but have struggled to do is how do we relate that disability material culture to modern disabled people? How do we have meaning-making processes with historic material around disability and by disabled people? And hence why I use the term disability heritage, where I think heritage studies is really helpful for thinking about this stuff.
Yeah.
Because we sometimes contain versions of disability to the past or say that its significance or the stories we should tell about it have already happened. They are already done. There is nothing we can do.
Yeah.
But that's just simply one way of looking at objects, and it's quite a restrictive way of looking at objects.
Very restrictive way of thinking about the past and thinking about materiality too, isn't it?
Yes, and I think it also needs to understand that we need to value disabled experience now and in the present, and that there are disabled cultures. There is continuity, and there is even more than that, connection.
Mm.
There are elements of disabled experience which exist through many time periods and through many places. And disabled people have a right to access the materials of their own cultures. And sometimes I get a bit frustrated with accessibility because it can feel like I'm fighting for access to somebody else's history, to an able-bodied history or an able-minded history.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that museums can really jump on and do well, that maybe traditional academia and archaeology, particularly in that it's often focused on the material and what has actually happened to the material previously and not as much on what we do with it in this moment.
You're listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My guest for this episode is Lauren Poole. Lauren, it's kind of interesting. We've been talking about disability interpretations, material culture, and so on. But the concept of disability knowledge and interpretations of not just artifacts, but history and more broader societal knowledge from the perspective of people living with disability, how might that be brought into a museum narrative? And how could we actually begin to reframe some of those conversations and discussions?
Yeah, that's a great question, Craig. I quite like the phrase crip knowledge, which I know most people have not heard of and would be a bit startled by.
Mm.
So crip knowledge obviously comes from the derogatory term cripple and refers to ways of being, ways of knowing, ways of living that disabled people have and create and use. And I think it's a really helpful term to think about how we interpret objects, because it sort of clashes quite uncomfortably with the medical ways that we often interpret disability objects, these very top-down, almost institutional, technical understandings, which then means that we often only look for disability in medical objects.
Yes, not day-to-day life pieces.
Yes. Crip knowledge involves a lot more than scientific information. It encompasses so much more. I think it's really helpful to work against hierarchical and institutional readings by having something that is community-based, that is created and sustained by the disabled community. And crip knowledge is also strongly linked to ideas around crisis and how to live through crisis and how to deal with crisis and make meaning of crisis. So my favorite example of crip knowledge in action is when the first lockdowns hit and everybody was stuck at home, and a lot of non-disabled people had never had that before. There were so many guides, if you can remember, about like how to make a meaningful routine at home and how to stay in contact with friends and what to do about this when you're having an existential crisis because you're worried about your health and your family's health and what's going to happen to all of you and your entire future seems to be in jeopardy. And a lot of those pieces were written by disabled people.
Yeah.
And it was knowledge spread by disabled people saying, this is how we live like this. This is what we do. And we are sharing our knowledge with you about how to get through this and what this might mean for your life. And it's not just, oh, here's a bunch of resources, but here's the tools.
Yeah.
Here is, I'm going to show you, I'm going to teach you. I really like Stacey Milburn's idea of crip doulas or crip mentors, that when you become disabled, and I had this in my own life, you will come across people in your life who are already disabled and they will teach you things that nobody else can tell you about.
Yeah.
And they will bring you into a disabled way of living in a disabled community. And so crip knowledge is a really great way of describing some of that transmission and also giving value to disabled knowledge, saying this is something that exists that the museum does not have control of. Simply having a medical collection, which is understood by particular doctors, doesn't mean that it's understood from a disability perspective, doesn't mean that it's incorporating these things. There is value in crip knowledge and disabled ways of knowing and being.
But conversely, could objects and materiality be used as part of that transfer of knowledge?
Absolutely. Yeah, so I found even in my own life, objects and materialities are a real big part of crip knowledge. And when I became disabled, people taught me, okay, these are the compression garments that aren't hideous. These are the ones that are most comfortable. This is where you need to buy these things. This is the way you need to think of how do we actually move through life and move through time and use these different objects in disabled ways. And they're not always openly disabled objects. And I think that's sometimes important for us to remember that anything can be a disabled object. Anything can be used by a disabled person in a disabled way. It's really broadening up the possibilities when we look at collections to say, all this could all be disability material culture. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
It's very exciting, actually, isn't it? Because suddenly you've realized that it's a whole new perspective in terms of thinking about collections and thinking about objects, full stop.
Yeah, and it also is sort of a reaction away from assuming everything is non-disabled to sometimes sit back and go, it's all disabled. Disabled people have touched everything in this collection, I guarantee you.
Yes. So let's bring it back to the cotton suit before we wrap up. Having spent all this time researching and reading about it and contextualizing it within other questions that are bouncing around your head at the moment, but also having seen the cotton suit in the flesh, how do you find yourself responding to it, particularly by adding that additional lens of interpretation?
I find, even just preparing for this podcast, thinking through all of these things, I get quite unexpectedly emotional about the suit, but I think that's less to do with the literal fabric of being upset about the fact that the rubber is crumbling and we need to preserve it and it's falling apart, or even how it's displayed in that it's very obviously a body in a museum, which we can have quite visceral reactions to, or the form of a body in a museum. But I think getting emotional has more to do with the recognition that this object is part of disability history, disability cultures, and then that feeling it's part of our histories, our cultures, and that recognition of connection for me with dysautonomia, with this particular piece, of my experience of it and of so many other people's through histories and through the present. I think that's something museums are really wonderful at, is having those moments of recognition, of displays where the visitor sees something that they recognize themselves in and what that can do. And as a disabled person, to look at the cotton suit, which is so carefully laid out and lit and written about, to see a set of objects specifically relating to my daily experience of blood pooling is very special.
Now, look, the question everyone who appears on the podcast gets asked, whether they like it or not, is the one word question. If you could choose any one word from the English language to represent how the cotton suit, or what the cotton suit signifies for you, what's that one word you would choose?
Honestly, and it's not a great word, hypoxia. Hypoxia, which is a medical term. It's the term for lack of oxygen from blood pulling away from your vital organs. But I think it does sum up what I feel is important about this object, which is the embodiment and the experience of blood pooling, which is what the suit engages with. It's the problem it tried to deal with. It's what the people wearing it would have felt. It's what I experience. And part of that is going, there is real value in disabled experience, in disabled embodiment. There is value in what I know about blood pooling and how I can relate to it. And I can also say that that is an experience, and part of the suit's a part of its history that most non-disabled people don't have.
I don't want to use the word unique because, of course, you're not the only person, but it's giving you a really interesting insight and perspective. So thank you for sharing that. I very much appreciate it.
I could talk about it forever.
Well, on that note, I mean, the final question I'm going to ask you is, again, so given it is an object which is currently on public display, for any of our listeners who come into the Chow Chak Wing Museum and see it, you've covered so much over the last half hour, but is there anything in particular you want them to walk away thinking about when they see the cotton suit?
Probably, why are we telling this particular story about this particular object? And what are we assuming is important or relevant or and very big quotation marks, normal.
Yeah.
And why do we make those choices? Objects aren't just vessels of historical information. We choose every day how and why we value them and what stories they can tell. So what other stories could this tell? And also, frankly, while you're in the exhibition, try and find other disabled objects, because they're there. They are always there.
Yeah.
They just need to be recognized and then actively engaged with.
I think that's a challenge for me, and I hope that's a challenge for our listeners. Lauren, thank you so much for sharing your insight. Thank you for your time. I very much appreciate it. I cannot think of the cotton suit in the same way I used to now, and I think that's a valuable lesson for all of us, that we do need to rethink, don't we? And we do need to re-engage the conversation. So thank you for your time, and thank you for sharing your stories.
Thank you for having me. It's been a joy. We could talk about disability histories all day.
Let's have you back. Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The University of Sydney and the Chowchacwing Museum acknowledges the traditional owners of the country in which the museum is located, and we pay our respect to elders past, present, and future.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chowchacwing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.